and welcome to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio. Today, we're going to be talking about balancing soil fertility on your farms. And when I think about this, it's a different conversation for so many of our fields on our own farm that, wow, this field over here, we're going to take one strategy, and this field over here is going to be totally different. And when I think for so long of how fertility was managed, boy, there's a lot of programs still today that are managing, well, here's my program for corn, and I'm going to do the same thing on every acre. And we know that can't be the best way, but how do we figure out what is the best way where we can really manage it field by field and even acre by acre as we're going through that field? As Brian, my brother, would tell you, he wants to manage it plant by plant eventually. And wow, will that be entertaining when you have, let's just say, 30,000 corn plants per acre or 120,000 soybean plants per acre, and you're going to manage each plant a little differently. That would be awesome to be able to do that. And we probably will be doing that before we know it. So anyway, we're going to get into some of those soil fertility questions today, and we're going to have some good conversations coming up. You're going to like some of the guests that we've got on the show. We'll also be taking your calls and questions throughout today. 844-44-AG-PHD. If you'd like to talk about anything on your farm, but a specific fertility issue would be great. That'd go right with what we're talking about today. But of course, any agronomic topic is fine. You can also send us an email, radio@agphd.com, or you can find us on Twitter, AgPhD Media, Brian Hefty or Darren Hefty. So I was talking with an agronomist this morning who was heading out to the field with a deep soil core in mind. And he had a grower who wanted to see what difference were the cover crops making on his ground. And I thought it was interesting. We just got into the discussion as far as, well, are cover crops the right thing in this situation, that situation, especially as you move north? I think as you move south and you've got a longer growing season, and especially as you move south and east in the United States, as you get more moisture as well, well, I think cover crops are great. I think it's almost a no-brainer in a lot of situations. But as you come north, the question is, how do you get it to work? I was just talking to a high school classmate of mine yesterday, and he said, you know, I want to figure out how to do this on a short growing season, because unless we're seeding the crop, seeding the cover crop into our standing crop, it's going to be pretty tough for me to get enough growing season to make a big impact. And, you know, of course, the farmers that have got a three-crop rotation where wheat is in the rotation, it sure helps when you're harvesting, you know, in June, July, August, depending on where you're at in the country, you got some months there where you can get some good growth. So the agronomist I was talking to this morning was heading out to a field to see, you know, what was the impact? Because oftentimes we're looking at 0 to 6 inch or maybe 0 to 8 or 0 to 12 inch. We're looking at that top portion of the soil to see what impact we're making with our practices. But he was really curious to see what's happening down in the 12 to 18 inch, in the 18 to 24 inch range. Are we actually doing anything by pushing all these roots down deep when they're breaking down? Are they building organic matter? Are they releasing nutrients? And, you know, we talk to people all across the country that say, wow, I've been doing cover crops for quite a while, and it's been a real positive for me. There are definitely some positives. There's no doubt about it. The question is, what about in the short season? Can you get that to happen too? Also, got into some discussions yesterday with some farmers involving lime and different ways to improve calcium in the soil and get that into balance, like we're going to talk about a little bit today, but also to affect pH. And when you've got a pH that's way out of balance, if a neutral pH is 7 and you've got a pH down at 5, so it's 100 times more acidic, or you've got a pH at 8 and it's just way too high, we're limiting nutrient uptake, we're inhibiting microbial activity, and those things are big when we talk about just feeding the crop and being successful. So I got into this high pH discussion, and one of the growers that happened to get into the conversation, he's like, well, hey, I just want you to know, I had a strip of corn that went 320 on my farm, and we soil tested to see, wow, we must be doing something right, and it turned out to be one of those spots where we had a pH that was up towards 8, and he goes, how can that be? And I said, what do you mean? How can that be? Of course, it happens all the time that farmers with an 8 pH, that doesn't mean you can't be successful. It just means that, wow, there's potentially more yield on the table if we could get that pH down for his, in his area, if we could get it down into the mid sixes, that would be tremendous in terms of nutrient availability and the potential for certain nutrients to get into the crop a lot better and for microbial activity to improve. Who knows? Who knows what the difference could be? And he's like, well, what's it going to be? If I'm 320 now, if I can get that pH down, can I get 350? Maybe if you get the same conditions you had this year, that would be possible. So yeah, it's just neat to see what you can do balancing soil fertility. So I mentioned our farm and some of the different challenges that we're facing. We've really focused on N, P, and K first in terms of nutrients. And we've also looked at sulfur and we get into this discussion often with Neil Kinsey, and he says, actually look at how many pounds of sulfur your crop is going to need, how many it's going to remove, how many it's going to take up. Sulfur is really a primary nutrient. It's one that you need a lot of pounds of. And so keep that one in mind too. So N, P, K, and sulfur. Then you look at calcium and magnesium. And I know some of the people that we talked to on the show today are really going to focus on, hey, calcium and magnesium are important when you think about just porosity in the soil, air in the soil, and allowing our root systems to move through. We've got some soils that are just way too high in magnesium, for example, that are always sticky and tough and just impossible. I know my grandpa and my dad, too, both suffered with some high magnesium soils trying to get crops to grow. So we'll talk about getting those big pieces in place. And then when you do get the big pieces in place, there's still more things to work on with micronutrients, and that on some of our farm, especially some of the ground we've had for a long time, that's the next challenge for us, is figuring out how do we get better nutrient availability out of these micros and how much exactly do we need on them? I realize it's down the road a little bit for some of your farms. If you've picked up some new ground, you're still working on N, P, K, and sulfur. But we will talk about the full package here, all the way down into some of the micronutrients on today's program. We're talking balancing soil fertility, and we're taking your calls and questions as well at 844-44-AG-PHD. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
It's tough to keep your stored soybeans in perfect condition. To maintain beans at 13% moisture, you need to run your bin fans when outside air humidity is at 70%. For 12% moisture, you need to run at 65%. For 11, 60. How can you possibly get the timing right yourself if you don't know the humidity at your bin site and aren't there to switch on your fans? The Steps GMS Temperature Humidity Switch is your low-cost solution. For more information, visit us at stepsgms.com.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
Want to turn smart agronomics into smart economics? Go with the all-new Grow Smart Rewards program. 1. Start with a smart agronomic plan. 2. Qualify with the purchase of a participating BASF herbicide. 3. Earn $1+ per acre for each qualifying pair-up brand. Plus, you may qualify for an additional $75 per gallon back on our industry-leading fungicides. For full program details, go to growsmartrewards.com. Grow smart with BASF.
No secrets here. We all know, regardless of the markets, balanced crop nutrition pays. Agro-liquid fertilizers have the research, technology, and products you need to grow a great crop. We also have an outstanding team of field agronomists ready to help you determine the best use of your fertilizer dollar. Agro-liquid can help you maximize your yield potential effectively and economically. Visit agroliquid.com to find a dealer near you.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. You know, we've gotten so many questions about fertility coming out of the fall of 2018. A lot of guys did not get fertility out there, so they weren't able to go with their initial plan or what they had thought was going to be the game plan going into the 2019 growing season. And so a lot of changes being made. And we've got John Leaf with us right now with AgriLiquid. John, thanks for joining us today.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
You know, so what do farmers do? It's, oh, I meant to get a whole bunch of stuff done in the fall. Now I didn't get it done. So I'm going to be kind of compressed for time in the spring. What's the best way to feed those crops?
Well, feeding the crops, you need to, you know, make sure to get the nutrients on when they need them. You know, certainly if we could get some potassium and some lime out, even you know, later this winter when the ground is solid, we can start that process. But we just need to make sure to have those nutrients available come springtime, be it at planting or throughout the growing season.
You know, I think we get these big plans in mind sometimes, and I know our farm is sure guilty of this, and then the weather goes against us. There's no rush. We don't have to do something crazy. If we didn't get it done this year, we can certainly get it done next year. Like you mentioned the lime situation, and I know there were growers trying to get manure out and lime out and some of these things that, well, if conditions aren't really good in the field, there's no point tearing up the field trying to get it done, is there?
Oh, absolutely not. You can do so much more harm by compacting your soils and tearing things up than you would ever get the benefit from these fall applications. So really do need to keep track of the soil conditions so that you make sure to manage that soil well so that you have a good productivity in the future.
You know, going into next spring, for farmers looking at soil tests that got pulled this fall, and we get questions all the time about how do I know if I'm going to get a better return on investment, putting money into P or putting money into K, and how much do I really need to have there for a good, successful crop?
Well, first of all, you need to understand, you know, what your soil levels are. That soil test is pretty vital in helping you to determine that. And then making sure that your nutrients are in balance. That's also another important thing that the soil test can give you. And then finally, the nutritional needs of the crop. What does that crop need? Soybeans are going to need a whole lot more potassium. Corn can use a lot more phosphorus. So those are just some of the factors that you need to consider.
You know, the NPK and sulfur are certainly big items on the list, no doubt about it. But the micronutrients on a year like this where economics look a little tough are one area that I think growers are really curious about. You know, hey, I've got $5 budgeted or $10 budgeted to put out a micronutrient blend or to address a specific micronutrient issue. When do you pull the trigger on that? And when do you say, you know, I'm going to wait to address that. I'm going to focus on NP and K first instead.
Yeah, micronutrients are one of those topics that, you know, micro makes it sound like it's not that necessary, but they are extremely necessary in small amounts. If you've got, you know, budgetary constraints, you really do need to understand that balance between, you know, the NPK and then is that micronutrient that you're looking at, is that the limiting factor? Is your zinc levels so low that even a good phosphorus and potassium nitrogen would just not be all that valuable if you don't have at least a modest level of zinc? So that's the question you need to ask with a lot of these micronutrients.
You know, in so many areas of our life, we know there are some big differences. If you order a steak, you're kind of curious about what cut it is because you know that a steak is not a steak, right? If you can get a filet, you've got something pretty special. And a car is not a car. I mean, you've got a Cadillac or you've got something that's not a Cadillac. How about fertility? You know, for a lot of farmers, they've heard this for years, and it just hasn't been good information to hear, well, a pound is a pound. There's certainly big differences. What should growers be looking at to understand where they're really going to get more for their money?
Sure. Well, they need to understand the nutrient availability of their products. Of course, AgriLiquid has a full line of products that are very highly available. So we can use less actual product and get more performance out of it. And then there's also issues of nutrient interactions in the soil, where if you have too much of one nutrient, it can adversely impact the availability of others. So having crop nutrition products that provide that crop nutrition, especially in some of those tougher circumstances, is very important.
Yeah, looking at the performance in fields and measuring things is something that on our farm we've been doing. We were so excited when we got a yield monitor, and that's cool and everything, but seeing where some of these differences are, really need to map them out where they're at in our fields as we're going through and weigh them out separately just to make sure we're seeing differences, whether it's a 10-bushel difference that pops up on the yield map or a 2-bushel difference that really gave us a really nice return on investment. And keeping an eye on those things throughout the season, whether it's with plant tissue testing or just visual observations and measurements, is really critical too. Been talking with John Leaf with AgriLiquid about balancing soil fertility. John, thank you so much. Really appreciate having you on.
All right. Thank you very much.
You know, Brian, we think about balancing soil fertility, and I can honestly say for every field that we've got, we do take a look at the soil samples. We are trying to adjust things out there to try and get the maximum yield. And for me, you know, the soil pH has got to be good, but we've got to have drainage. This is one of those things that if we don't have drainage, yeah, we can do a lot of stuff, but we just aren't going to get yield. That seems to be number one to me. And then once we get that drainage fixed, we're looking at some of the big adjustments like soil pH, and then we dive into N, P, and K. So we kind of have an order that we're working through. You know, for growers that are listening that picked up that new piece of ground, it's a little overwhelming. And you and I have both been in that situation over the last few years of, hey, here's a new piece of ground that needs a lot of help.
Okay, but
having the discipline to go through that progression and build it up over time is sometimes tough to do.
Yeah, but there are two different ways you got to look at this. When you say picked up a new piece of ground, did I buy it or am I now renting it? Because I'm going to handle those two things completely different if my rent is just a short-term deal. If I think I'm only going to have that ground for a year or two, there are a lot of these things that we can do to the soil that if we're going to do them, then we've got to share that with the landlord, because otherwise the future renter of that ground is going to get most of the benefit. If you look at lime, like you mentioned, if you look at P and K and a lot of the micronutrients, many of those are not going to get extracted this year if you go ahead and broadcast fertilizer. So that's the big concern that I've got. Now, it would be different if every farmer was rich and none of us had any money problems. Okay, then who cares? But let's face it, unfortunately, the farm economy is not real great right now. I don't want to spend a whole bunch of extra money to balance my soil fertility, to get all those things straight, if I don't know if I'm going to have that ground long term. You know, on the flip side, if I do own that ground, I am going to work on over time. I want to get it in shape, but then it basically becomes a budget issue. How much can I afford to spend? Because I might not get that all back this year. It might come back over the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, but do I need to have that money come back right now? So you may not be able to afford in the short term to get where you want to go. So I'm glad you said we take these things in order. pH is first, then we start working and the primary nutrients, and then go from there.
I think we get questions all the time, Brian, about, man, I'm really concerned about my boron level in my soil. And we want to see a whole soil test before we make that kind of judgment on our ground. We're concerned about boron too, but we want to get those big pieces in place first, because that's going to have the most impact on our yield this year and our profitability this year. Just adding one micro, I can't tell you how many times I've talked to people that said, well, I added boron and it didn't do anything for me. Yeah, it wasn't your yield limiting factor. You're dramatically short on phosphorus or something else. You've got to address those things first and then work on the micros. The micros are important, and I'm not saying don't apply them. We definitely are using them, but we're just not trying to build those up first. We'll talk more about balancing soil fertility coming up right after this.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential. Nutex EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutex EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutex EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
Are you frustrated with white mold showing up year after year in your soybeans? If you have tried fungicide applications and are still losing yield to white mold, now is the time to ask your seed dealer about Heads Up Plant Protectant. Heads Up is the first EPA-registered seed treatment for the prevention of white mold in soybeans and pulse crops. The first line of defense on your farm against white mold now starts with the right seed treatment package. Locate a Heads Up dealer near you by visiting headsupst.com today.
Hey, Bill, any advice to control tough weeds and rootworms?
That's easy, Jim. Buy two, save three.
Wait, for weeds and rootworms?
Buy two, save three. Combine your Impact or new Impact Z herbicide purchase with a qualifying insecticide and save $3 per acre.
Buy two, save three. That is good advice.
For details, go to buy2save3.com. Impact, Impact Z, and Buy Two Save Three are trademarks owned by AMVAC Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Your independent spirit is more rewarding than ever before. Unlike incentive programs that require growers to purchase a particular seed brand or to bundle certain products, the FMC Freedom Pass program rewards you for making the best choices for your fields. You decide what's best for your operation, from pre-plant to harvest. Your retailer and FMC take care of the rest. It's really that simple. The exclusive agronomic rewards, performance assurances, application innovations, and product financing of the FMC Freedom Pass program make it easier to protect your crops and cash flow. That's what we mean when we say we give you more freedom in the field. You'll experience more control and confidence, too. Generics and imitators can't promise that. Visit your authorized FMC retailer or FMCFreedomPass.com to calculate your potential financial incentive and learn more.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. We've got Bill Brush with us with B&B Ag Consulting out in California, talking a little soil fertility balancing. Bill, how's it going?
Good. How's things back in your neck of the woods?
Not too bad. We don't have any snow, Bill. It doesn't even feel like it's going to be Christmas.
Well, we actually got a little rain, so that for this state these days, that's a good thing.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, we're talking balancing soil fertility, and for a lot of growers in the Midwest, they didn't get fall fertility applications done, and now it's, oh boy, we're going to have to do all this work and get stuff planted in timely fashion. What's it like with a lot of the crops that you're working with in California? Because I would assume one crop comes out, another one's almost immediately going back in.
Yeah, it's a combination of, you know, a lot of the row cropping is done at least two, and a lot of the vegetables could be three turns a year. Whereas we do have a lot of permanent crops and wine grapes, table grapes, raisin grapes, almonds, walnuts, pistachios. So those are, you know, annual crops. Basically, they're permanent for somewhere at least 20 years to 30 years or so. So they're on a more normal schedule. The row croppers are actually more into, they're more worried about annualized because they got to get some work done two or three times different, you know, and planting different times during the year.
What happens on those permanent annual crops? You know, whether it's vineyards or tree crops, when you're talking about balancing soil fertility with a corn crop, I'm real familiar with that. We've got only so many dollars that we're willing to spend on an annual basis because we've got one crop that it's really going to influence. And then, okay, yeah, we've got some soil amendments and so forth. But what about these permanent annual crops? Do growers try to address it all at once as they could impact the life of that tree for the next 20 years?
You know, I think that out here with limited rainfall in many areas of the state, particularly here in the Central Valley, one of the things you have to always look at is not only your soil fertility, but what part does water play in diminishing your soil fertility? You know, I always kid with growers, the only thing worse than having bad water is having no water. And so we have to look at a lot of the different components in water to see how they are affecting those things that we amend with in the fall. We try to get it post-harvest and try to get most of our soil amending done at that time. And if we're going to do anything with micronutrients, that's also a good time to do it, although that can also be applied in the spring. You know, of course, some parts of the state getting on the ground is not an issue for the most majority of the season because of just not enough rainfall. You get down in the southern end of the valley where we only get 4 to 6 inches of rain and it's spread out. I mean, there's lots of avenues or openings to get your work done.
Now, when you think about some of these crops, like you mentioned some vegetables, where you're getting three turns out of the year, how much of that is in-crop fertility, or is a lot of it in between the crops that you get stuff done?
I think most of the time, you know, out here, things slow down in the wintertime. So after you harvest that winter crop, you know, and it could be anywhere from January, February, March. And that springtime is really, what I think, when things really go to work, because that's your best window. Because in the summer, you really want to turn fast. You want to go in and out. So you want to have to be waiting to do soil amending, although there's a lot of amending that's being done right over top of the rows with the form of gypsum and like that, to as used kind of as an anti-crusting, but also as a calcium source.
You know, the calcium is one that you talk about a lot, Bill, about getting the right amount of calcium out there. What are you shooting for, and where does that stack up on your priorities when it comes to N, P, and K, or calcium?
Well, you know, I think that one of the things about calcium I always like to say is it's not a very sexy product. You know, it's not the big nitrogen and phosphate and same things that we can see, but what it does, and the reason it's not that sexy, is we don't see the effects of it show up immediately. Like if your crop needs nitrogen or phosphate or potassium, you can put that on and actually see a response. With calcium, it's more how do we keep the soil structure? Because if you look at calcium and magnesium, there's 80% of everything held on the soil colloid that basically is your bank of nutrients to feed the crop. And if you add potassium, you got another 5 to 7% and a little bit of sodium, all of a sudden there's so much right there. But we look at the things we're buying more frequently in forms of nitrogen and phosphate and potash, and those were the big dollars we spent, so we're really in tune to those. I like to think, though, that balancing the soil, it's kind of like, you know, you can't say, do you want to balance your soil? You're going to say no. Or do you want healthy soil? No. Those are all yes questions. You know, we want to balance our soils. We want to have healthy soils. But it all starts with getting calcium and magnesium in proper proportions. And about in the mid to high 60s, low 70s is a good number. And trying to keep magnesium between, say, 10 and 15% of that that's on that soil colloid. That gives you the physical structure that then allows air to get in there, as calcium will basically pull that soil together, and magnesium, of course, is a very necessary element too in many functions of the plant. But it gives you an opportunity for the biology to go to work, and that truly is where the true nutrition happens in the soil, is through the biology.
You know, getting things in balance and getting that soil microbiology working is a big deal. And you mentioned a couple of the secondary nutrients there, calcium and magnesium, but sulfur is sure getting a lot of play. And we're hearing from a lot of high yielding and highly successful growers that it's influencing taste in different vegetable products. It's helping greatly in corn and other crops with nutrient efficiency and how nitrogen's used and so forth. What do you see with sulfur, and in the crops that you work with, is sulfur use on the rise?
Oh, sulfur, at least for me, is always the overlooked, one of the overlooked nutrients. It's NPKS, if you look right down your list of nutrients. And so it's in the fourth place, you know. And you have to remember that sulfur in the soil is going to be eventually turned to sulfate, which is a negatively charged ion. Very similar to nitrogen, which eventually either is applied as nitrate or turns to nitrate. So those nutrients, during the course of irrigation, rainfall, or whatever, are going to make their way through the soil. So it's going to be either use or lose. So as you start up, you've had a really good season of rainfall, a really good season of irrigation. Your sulfur is not going to be there for the following crop. So it's an annual application. You know, they are not held on that negatively charged soil colloid. So they have to basically move through the system. And they're taking usually something with them. So, but sulfate sulfur is a key. And what you said is very important in taste and sugar. Nitrogen efficiency is better with the proper amount of sulfur. And I usually shoot for about 50 pounds per acre, as a kind of a target for the minimum that we'd like to see in the soil. And that's in the sulfate form. So that's about the amounts you need. But it's a moving target as you irrigate. But there are a lot of products like an ammonium sulfate, a sulfate of potash, and just plain using elemental as a little bit of a soil amender to add sulfur in as it converts to sulfate. It'll give you a little acidity if you're running higher on the pH side.
Now, you mentioned moving target, and you're right. As the season progresses, you've got nutrient levels going up and down. You got microbial activity getting better or getting worse, depending on what's happening with moisture and temperature and everything. How do you measure those moving targets? Are you doing plant tissue tests? Do you do sap tests? What have you found that's been accurate?
One is, you know, just like most every farmer, experience is probably your best indicator. You know, we like to take soil samples as we get near the end of the season on these permanent crops where we can get into it. So it's a little more difficult on corn, but it's a great time to get nutrient levels where they are. And if you see that you're falling short of where you'd like to be at the end of the year, then you're going to have to change your program. Well, one of the things with your row crops or corn particularly is once the crop is developed, it's very difficult to get any more material down to the floor.
Sure.
And so particularly on these rainfall, you know, that are being grown with rainfall only, you're kind of stuck. And so one of the things is to try to maybe give yourself a little bit of a balance of sulfate sulfur in the form of ammonium sulfate and maybe putting in some elemental sulfur down the line, because it'll take some time for it to convert over to sulfate during that growing time. So it gives you a little
absolutely.
More stretch on your sulfur.
You know, we're going to talk more about that right after this break. Stay tuned.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic has proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success. Like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
In 1949, Morton Buildings constructed our first machine storage building to establish our bond with the farming community. Since then, our relationship has grown, and so have our product offerings. From the smallest specialized operation to the largest agricultural enterprise, we understand the needs of your business and continue to evolve to meet industry demands. Plus, when you build a Morton building, you're backed by the strongest warranty in the business. To learn more about the Morton Advantage, visit us online at mortonbuildings.com.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? The Soil Warrior can reduce trips across the field, optimize nutrient placement, and improve soil health. So you can lower production costs without losing yield. See what makes the Soil Warrior different and better at soilwarrior.com.
Increase your productivity with Hypro's Dual React Control System. The dual nozzle body design allows you to drive at the speed you want while maintaining the rate and droplet size you need. Hypro, helping you spray better.
Every farmer knows that in order to be profitable, you need to maximize the return on your crop input investments. Hi, I'm Scott Harms, an AgriSk specialist with Grain PhD. Without an effective and flexible strategy, your grain marketing plan gets stuck in the mud. With Grain PhD, you get the clarity and guidance a solid marketing plan needs. Our free GrainBridge software simplifies your cost-profit analysis, and our risk specialists are here to help you develop your plan. Sign up today at GrainPhD.com.
For over a year, I've been butchering the scripts for the Farmer's Edge ads on my podcast. But hey, it's not my fault. Honestly, they offer too much stuff. On-farm weather stations, that little plastic data transfer thingy they shove in your tractor's port, daily satellite imagery, their integrated farm management software, soil sampling, variable rate technology, it goes on and on and on. And they expect me to do that in one ad. That's why I just say Farmer's Edge. It's a company developed by an agronomist to help make you a better farmer.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton studio today. We're talking about balancing soil fertility, taking your calls and questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. And Brian, before the break, Bill Brush with B&B Ag Consulting out in California made the comment about sulfur. And this is one that often gets neglected. And he said he'd like to see at least 50 pounds per acre average on soil tests as a minimum.
So 25 parts per million.
Yep. Yep, and no lower than that. I've looked at a lot of soil tests this winter that were single digits.
A lot lower. Yeah, I know. We've always kind of said 20 parts per million is a minimum, but I don't have any issue if a guy, you know, says 25 parts per million is his minimum. The point is sulfur is important. And what we said earlier, yep, I'd start with the primary nutrients. Just don't forget that if your crop is short on sulfur, then you need more nitrogen to compensate for that. And you're still not going to get where you need to go in terms of yield. So there's always this, you know, our topic today is balancing soil fertility, but there's always this balance component out there. I'll just give you an example. If you think about like human health, I mean, you will say, okay, well, it's good to eat meat. All right. Well, let's just say that I'm going to have some chicken for lunch, whatever. Okay. Well, let's say that for the next 6 months, all I eat is chicken. That's it. Okay. How healthy am I going to be? It's the same kind of thing if you say, well, in my soil, I'm just going to put on a whole bunch of nitrogen. I'm going to count on everything else should be there. Yeah. I wouldn't really count on that. You want to do some soil testing, and it's certainly possible that on your ground this year, you can cut back on some other things. That's what I tell people all the time. If I have data, then I know better where to invest those dollars. If I don't have any soil tests and I don't have any good data, I'm just guessing at it. And then I'm going to do probably, well, kind of what I've done before. Well, how can I get the most out of the dollars that I'm going to invest? That's what I'm after. Times are too tough to take chances and to guess at things. We got to have more good information. So I just really encourage you, do a good job with soil tests. You don't have to test all your acres every year or anything like that, but you do need to do grids or zones. You can't do composite tests. If you're just taking one test in the whole field, and let's say even it's an average across the whole field because you pulled a whole bunch of cores around the field, basically what's going to happen is half of the stuff you do is going to be too much fertilizer, and half is too little. Half is too low a pH, half is too high a pH. You're not getting any real good information by taking one test. You cannot believe the variance in fields. Start sampling, just even take one field and do some small grids. I'm talking 1 acre, 2.5 acres, maybe 5 acres at the very biggest. But do some smaller grids and just see the variability in your field. And what that's going to tell you is, boy, if you can just, in those spots that need the fertility, put the fertility there and put what you need there, you've got so much better chance at getting a good return on your fertilizer investment. And that's what we're trying to accomplish here.
You know, when it comes to fertility, it is a big expense on farms, and we want to turn that expense into an investment. One of the things we're going to be talking about at the winter workshops that we're doing, 101 ways to cut farm expenses now. So we're going to talk about this fertility piece of what's an expense and what's an investment, and how do you get a better return on investment? It's kind of like if we were talking about investing in the stock market, you'd want to hear, well, where am I throwing money away? I don't want to invest in that. What could I throw money into that is going to make me some money? And then what's going to really make me good money? And the cool thing is we've been farming for a long time. I don't mean just Brian and me, but although Brian is getting kind of old, he's been farming a long time.
I'm literally 2.5 years older than Darren.
I know. So. It's crazy. But they're a long 2.5 years, Brian. And, you know, when you think about it, farming has been going on for a long time. So we've been able to learn a lot of things about fertility. And that information is out there, and we want to share that with you about, wow, how do I see on my soil test what's going to be a good return on my investment this year?
All right, let's get to the Ag PhD mailbag.
It's the mailbag!
All right, I got a question from Dave, and Dave sent in some samples here, some soil samples. He said, first of all, I love your show, and I love the Ag PhD Insider magazine. Thanks a lot, Dave. I really appreciate that. He said, I've got this field, and I'm wondering what you would recommend I apply. It's been no-till for 20-plus years, and I had 204 bushel corn last year, and I'm going into soybeans. It's always a corn-soybean rotation. So what would you do going into soybeans this year, shooting for 55 to 65 bushel beans? First of all, normally what I look at, Dave, is I'll say if I'm getting 204 bushel corn, I should be getting 65 to 70 bushel beans.
Right.
So I'm going to go for your higher end here and say we should be up probably in that 65 bushel range, because normally if we're raising corn, we should be able to get about one-third as many bushels out of soybeans.
Where we always start is looking at soil pH. His soil pH levels are all in the range of 6.3 to 6.7. Perfect. Great job. Okay, we got one thing we can check off the list. Then I'm going to start looking at what type of soil do I have? How heavy is it? And how much do I have for organic matter? He's got roughly 2.5 to 3% organic matter. I am not seeing anything on here that says his cation exchange capacity number, though. So I don't know if we're dealing with heavy or light soil. Let's see. Oh, no, I'll take that back. It's estimated CEC he's got down here, 11 or 12. Sorry, it's a different lab. I've never looked at these samples before. Darren just handed it to me. But anyway, 11 or 12, so it's kind of medium textured soil, I would call that. If I look at base saturation test, I don't have the base saturation numbers. Now, I can calculate some things, but I don't have all the information I would like to have. So one of the first things I look at on the base saturation test is how is my potassium compared to my other nutrients? And just I'm going to guess here without running the numbers, he's got 80 parts per million potassium up to 108, you're low. And part of the reason why your corn yields are good and your bean yields are less than what Darren was talking about, because we talk about this ratio between corn and beans, and you're below that level on soybeans. I can almost guarantee you, in fact, I go so far as to say, I can promise you, part of the reason why you're having a problem is your potassium levels are too low. The need for potassium in a good soybean crop is higher than the need for potassium in a good corn crop on a per day basis at the peak. You do not have enough potassium to hit that yield level. I would be absolutely, especially if I owned this ground, I'd be building that up. Your phosphorus levels are also very low, 10 parts per million to 19 parts per million. On my farm, I'm shooting for 100 parts per million of available P1 phosphorus. Now, I'm not saying you need to get to 100, but you need to get it up higher than 10 to 19. So you absolutely need P and K. And also, soybeans respond better to good soil levels as opposed to, oh, we're going to apply some right now. So to think that in these low soil test areas, we're going to be able to get great beans this year, it's probably not going to happen. We can improve the yield, but we're probably not going to get where we want to go this year. But if I own that ground, I'd be working on this build here over the next couple of years. So the next time that we raise soybeans, we can come back and we've got ample potassium and phosphorus there for our beans. Now, your manganese levels are good. I like that. Your zinc levels are not too bad. The only micronutrient that I see here, and by the way, I don't see any tests on iron or copper, so I can't comment on those. I'd like to see those. But your boron levels are really low. You're at 0.4 parts per million of boron, so I would absolutely consider applying at least a little bit of boron to that soil as well.
All right. Had a follow-up to yesterday's show. This is Kevin from Minnesota, and he said, all right, listen to your inoculating soybeans radio show. I got a question. How do I best apply inoculant to my soybean seed if my seed supplier will only do it if I put on a fungicide insecticide seed treatment with it, but I don't want the fungicide insecticide seed treatment. I just want the inoculant. I'm using a seed tender to fill my 24-row box planter, and like most farmers, I'm dumping my hard sides right into the tender. So I'm wondering, what would you do in this case for putting soybean inoculant on soybean seed? And then also, how about quick rits on corn seed? I'm using the same setup to feed my corn planter.
Okay. Throwing a whole bunch of stuff at me and I got 30 seconds. So
perfect.
I need more time, but I would just say, first of all, I'm a huge believer in the fungicide insecticide. So I'd look hard at that as long as the cost is not too great on the soybeans. If I'm going to put inoculant on myself, I'm going to do it as a peat-based product. It doesn't cost much. You're talking about $2 an acre. You can either dump it in your machine or you can get an applicator like a CT applicator and it will put it on right in that that auger. Same thing with the quick rits. You could use a CT applicator, put that on as a dry product right as you're going to fill your planter box. Or certainly you could treat your corn seed ahead or dump the dry in the box as you go.
All right, we'll talk more about that and take more of your questions right after this.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotam North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
For over a year, I've been butchering the scripts for the Farmer's Edge ads on my podcast. But hey, it's not my fault. Honestly, they offer too much stuff. On-farm weather stations, that little plastic data transfer thingy they shove in your tractor's port, daily satellite imagery, their integrated farm management software, soil sampling, variable rate technology, it goes on and on and on. And they expect me to do that in one ad. That's why I just say Farmer's Edge. It's a company developed by an agronomist to help make you a better farmer.
In farming, there's a lot of variables out of our control. Don't let fertility be one of them. Let the experts at AgroLiquid move you closer to your bullseye. It's true. AgroLiquid fertilizers are formulated to keep nutrients available to your crop, and they have unmatched compatibility with other nutrients and crop protection products, which makes application more efficient than ever. But we also have the best people in the field, ready to talk about your operation, your goals. Go to agroliquid.com to move you closer to your target.
Are you combining around weed patches, waiting for weeds to dry down, or tired of spring burndown failures? Save time, nutrients, and moisture by including a Valor herbicide brand in your fall burndown program. Valor provides excellent residual control of tough weeds, including kochia, mare's tail, prickly lettuce, dandelion, plus suppression of bromes. Proactive, effective weed resistance management starts in the fall. Get a clean start for your next season with Valor herbicide brands. Always read and follow label directions.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic is proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
No two seasons are the same, so you need your crops to rise ready for whatever's in store. Now, there's one simple decision that provides coverage on four fronts. The Acceleron portfolio offers protection against disease, insects, nematodes, and even moisture or nutrient stress. In the fight against the unpredictable, rise stronger with Acceleron seed treatment products. Learn more at AcceleronSAS.com/rise-ready. Performance may vary. It's important to use proper PPE when handling treated seed.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio, broadcasting from the Morton Studio today. Just before the break, we had a question from Kevin in Minnesota asking about putting on his own inoculant and putting on his own quick rits on seed corn. Of course, you can find some companies that are already putting the quick rits on the seed corn in advance. That would be one way to do it. And the other thing on the inoculant, Brian, back when we were growing up, we had a little basically a one nozzle liquid setup on an auger, and it worked okay for.
Can't do that, Darren. You can't do that, Darren, because he's going right into the planter. I thought he said.
Well, that's true. I guess if you're going right into the planter. But I was going to say, if you're dumping those boxes into the seed tender, that's where I would do it. And then you've got that time while it's in the seed tender heading out to the field.
Yeah, but then you'd have to auger it out of the box. And I don't think he's going to do that.
Well, maybe not. But that would be another option.
So unless I misunderstood, I don't think that's going to be an option.
I'm with Brian. My first option would be use the dry peat base product and treat it right in the box. Thanks for the question, Kevin. I got Dave on with us right now. He farms in Minnesota. Dave, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Doing quite well. You know, when you think about balancing soil fertility, it changes a little bit when you're talking about no-till versus conventional till. How about in the strip till? What have you found that's worked? Are you putting a lot of your fertility right in that strip?
I put all my product right in the strip. I think of it as, you know, when you broadcast and then till it in, you maybe have a seed prep zone that's 2.5-3 inches deep. With the strip till machine, I have a zone that's about 6 inches wide and 9 inches deep. And it seems like if I were a corn seed, I'd like my roots to find their way into a nicely prepared zone 6 by 9 inches instead of just 2.5-3 inches deep.
Yeah, it certainly makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, my Soil Warrior machine does a great job of applying fertilizer, and I have found that I can, do soil tests, but then cut back on my total fertilizer program probably 25% with no yield impediment. So it seems to work well for me.
You know, one of the questions we get from a lot of farmers who haven't tried strip tillage before is, all right, so what is a farmer like Dave doing? Is he moving that strip around, or is he always farming that same strip every year?
No, I plant strip till corn, and then I use a no till drill to plant my beans the succeeding year. So I don't worry about moving the zone from one side to the other or down the middle, because by the second year, it's pretty well dissipated. But if I grow corn on corn, then I definitely do move into the centers of the old rows and set things up so I'm running down the centers.
You know, as you're doing those soybeans, do you notice any variability in the beans? Do you try to balance that fertility out, what you're doing in that zone where fertility is similar then all the way across the bean field?
Yeah, I will broadcast some P and some K and maybe some sulfur occasionally. And then the drill that I use does a pretty good job of stirring up the soil, maybe a half inch deep or so. And so I get some incorporation of a broadcast for beans. So my bean fertility is pretty good. And I don't depend on the leftovers from corn. I actually fertilize right on top of the corn stalks and then go right in with the drill and plant.
Yeah, I like the approach of fertilizing for each crop that you're going to do. I totally agree with you about that. That's our strategy, too, is to each year look at what we're going to put out there and try and put the fertility out to balance things out in the soil and also to feed that crop the most efficient way we can. You know, as you're looking at the strip till, Dave, are you making any changes going into this next year? Did you get a lot of that work done in the fall, or are you going to have to do it in the spring?
Well, I have done some extensive yield checking of fall strips with PK and some micronutrients, and then come back with a refresher pass in the spring with urea. And I have found that the extra trip is not worth the extra half a bushel per acre that I was getting. So I do it all in the spring.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting. I like that, to give growers like our own farm a little bit of encouragement that, yep, it can be done. And I know there are a lot of guys really nervous that, oh man, I've always done it in the fall and I didn't get it done last year because we got too wet or the season was too short. And yeah, it still can be done and done well. Dave, thank you so much. We really appreciate hearing about what you're doing on the farm, and good luck here going into the next season.
Well, thanks for the good show. We'll talk to you later.
You bet. Thanks. Brian, I get a question in from Josh, and speaking about a wet fall, Josh said, yeah, we had a wet fall, and we were just lucky to get our crop out, much less get any other fall work done. I'm wondering, do you have any options that we could spray in the cold wintertime to keep our fields clean before spring hits? Didn't know if something like your Cort de Banville that you had used on some of those tough winter annuals would have much effect since it's gotten so cold.
Where's he from?
North Carolina, I believe.
Yeah, because winter means whole different things for me as opposed to somebody from North Carolina. So up here, you know, cold kills everything. So that I'm not worried about. For down there,
well, I think, you know, when you've got wet ground, when you've got wet ground and you can get out when it's firm, I think that's a strategy that some growers would like to use. Is there a way I could do it? And we talk about it a lot.
Whoa. When the ground is firm, you're talking about when the ground is frozen. Why would I go spray herbicide when the ground's frozen?
No. Here's what I'm talking about. If we get out, say, like in our area, things start to thaw out really in April. So say we're in late March and we're getting those days where it's going to warm up and be in the 40s during the day and then it's in the 20s at night.
Yeah, that's spraying a pre-emerge herbicide. I don't think that's at all what he's asking there. He's asking about weed control in the wintertime because he didn't get stuff done in the fall, right?
Well, he said keeping the fields clean in the spring. So that's what I was kind of thinking that.
Oh, he said, well, then
What can I spray in the cold wintertime to keep fields clean?
I didn't hear you use the word spring.
To keep fields clean before spring hits. So I don't know how you take that, Josh. Is that killing off weeds that are out there? Or is that just I want to get a residual out there so I don't have to fight weeds in the spring?
That's muddy. That question, when you add the last words there, that tells me we're worried about spring. So now I'm with you. Okay, so I'm not worried about this winter kill. What I'm worried about is I'll call it early spring, or it might be late winter where you're at, according to the calendar. But the point is, where Darren was going with that is, once the ground gets to the point where it should be thawing out, you can go out in the mornings when the ground is still froze, spray a residual herbicide, and then in the afternoons when the ground is thawing, then that herbicide will attach itself to soil. You will get it into the ground. You will then have plenty of time to get moisture on it before those weeds start growing. You'll have that residual out there. It should work very nice. So we've done that. We've had people do that all over the place. Works great. So that's what I would do. Just pick the right herbicide that has at least, preferably, two effective modes of action on whatever weed you're going after.
All right. Thanks for the question. We really appreciate that, Josh. I got one from Michael in Iowa yesterday that we talked about a little bit, mainly concerning the nitrogen portion of this. He's putting on some chicken litter, and he's also doing some anhydrous and also some spring 32%, if you remember that question, Brian. He said, I wanted to add some clarification to some of my questions yesterday. First of all, that anhydrous application was 200 pounds of product, so only 164 pounds of actual N.
Got it.
And secondly, the 110 pounds of 32% is actually only 35 pounds of nitrogen.
Okay, so yeah, because when we were talking about that yesterday, I just remember that question, and it was getting upwards of 350, 400 pounds of nitrogen, and I'm going, whoa, that sounds like an awful lot. So yeah, that helps quite a bit. But our whole point in yesterday when we were talking about this is just take it easy on the early season nitrogen. The only time where we see it really important to get lots of early season nitrogen on is especially in our country where we only have a little early season rain and then it's super dry the rest of the year.
Okay, the other thing he said, I understand my micros are very short. I can see where after the chicken litter, I'm still significantly short on sulfur, copper, manganese, and magnesium, and probably others. What do you suggest, a particular application or liquid or dry products? Yeah, you're going to have to address those. There's no product that's got all of those things in it.
Yeah, but if he's got some of those in that litter, then it's not bad. He might have enough to feed the crop this year, but if he's trying to build the soil, yeah, there are some things that you can add individually or make your own blend and bump it a little bit more. But yeah, send us more information, more soil tests, all that kind of stuff. We love taking those types of questions. We can help you.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Really appreciate it. And thanks to you for listening. And be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio. Now stay tuned for Rob Sharkey and Shark Farmer Radio.